this final edition of the news for season 10, Mezcal Boom raises ethical issues, a landmark moment for Australian whiskey, and non-alcoholic beer brand Sober launches crowdfunding campaign. The global popularity of Mezcal is a double-edged sword for the Mexican communities who produce the spirit. That's according to Melanie Simmons, who spoke with Drinks Adventures about the origins of her brand, Kikiriki Mezcal, in our full-length episode last week. I asked Melanie separately for her thoughts on Constellation Brands' recent acquisition of a stake in Dos Hombres, the artisanal Mezcal brand started by Breaking Bad stars Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul in the latest of a groundswell of Mezcal deals involving multinational companies.
You know, normally when a big liquor brand buys a smaller brand, they've got these ambitions of being able to scale it and make more. And you know, something about Mezcal is supposed to be that it is small batch. It is made in small amounts. So can you kind of get your head around what's going on with these deals?
I've said a few times, I've really seen the Mezcal industry in Oaxaca and globally change so much in 10 years. I think my views as well have changed over those 10 years. If you'd have asked me this kind of a few, 5-6 years ago, I would have been very adamant that Mezcal can only be made, you know, by the one producer and do all these things, and anyone kind of trying to scale it up is disingenuous to kind of the true authenticity of Mezcal. But then on the flip side of that, you also have families and like I said, communities who, you know, they're poor, and any opportunity for them to grow and become businessmen and women and to bring money into the, you know, their family and the community and employ people and create jobs. And then, you know, that filters onto the agave farmers. So I think to say that you should only ever make it in tiny small batches, traditionally how it used to be, I kind of feel that's very unfair to the people, you know, who are making it. And I talked to some producers who want to remain small and are very much kind of only interested in producing, you know, limited batches kind of as they have been doing. But I also, you know, speak and work with a family that actually were like, we've been making this for generations, but it would be amazing to have our whole family employed by this. It'd be amazing to, you know, be able to employ the village and create kind of, you know, money and kind of commerce in that village and have people coming to visit and stuff. So I think there's a balance. The way that Mezcal is traditionally made, that's not really getting kind of the most out of an agave. You kind of have to start looking at technology and, you know, kind of other methods of extraction and et cetera, et cetera. And then you end up in a place where you have diffusers and, you know, factories, and some Mezcals are made by that. Do I like it? No. Do I want to sell it? Will I promote it? Absolutely not. But if you want Mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise. And you're going to have to allow a level of kind of industrialization or allow certain people to go down that route if that's what they want to do. I think you can do that responsibly. I don't like the way it's been done. I don't think some brands have done that.
Simmons says there are a multitude of ethical and environmental concerns posed by the way that some brands are currently doing business in Oaxaca.
Can you turn around and say that all the workers are being paid fairly? Can you turn around and say you're paying the right price for your agave if you're not growing them? And 99% of Mezcal brands are not growing their own agave. They're buying them. You know, I live in Oaxaca part-time. I'm really lucky to work with a family who really care about all these issues. We have responsibility practices. We have a agave nursery. So we reseed, we replant, we work with the local colleges to invite them in to run kind of courses on how to replant agave and try and get kind of, you know, the younger community interested in replanting, because that's really the focus has to be on how can we kind of create enough agave and grow enough agave for this increasing demand to make mezcal. And the runoff from mezcal production is another area that's a big issue. There's, I think, over 200 palenques in Matatlan, the village and the surrounding area. And to my knowledge, only two of those people have a vinyasis disposal unit. So vinyasis is a really acidic runoff that you get from making mezcal. And if everyone's putting vinyasis back into the water, that's going to change the pH level. But to build a vinyasis disposal unit, which is like a composter, is really expensive. Kikiriki kind of got bigger and the family bought another palenque. They were able to afford to make a vinyasis disposal. And then I think there's only two, that them and one other person, to my knowledge and to their knowledge, has a vinyasis disposal in Matatlan. So what's happening with all these other brands that are kind of, you know, putting pictures of all these, you know, naked people in agave fields and like talking about one love and sustainability and having agave parties? It's like, that's great. That looks really nice for the market. But how are you disposing of your runoff?
The Australian branch of the world's leading whiskey club, Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, has announced the upcoming release of two new bottlings from an undisclosed Australian distillery. The single cask releases from a distillery codenamed 148 follow the release of the Society's debut Australian bottling from Sydney-based distillery 147 earlier this year. National Ambassador Matt Bailey says it's a landmark event for the club, which, as its name would suggest, has to date largely focused its attentions on Scotch whisky.
It's true. We've bottled whisky outside of Scotland for some time, though. It's not really a new thing for us to be exploring international whiskies. The name would suggest that we only bottle Scotch whisky, which is incorrect. I mean, it was even as early as the beginning of the 90s where we first bottled an Irish whisky. Of course, members were outraged then. And there were stories of members tearing up their membership cards, as not wanting to be a part of it anymore because my beloved Scotch Malt Whisky Society was bottling Irish whisky. And that was back in about 1990 or 1991, somewhere around there. And then we bottled some American whiskies and Japanese whiskies, Indian whiskies, Swedish, and onwards we've been. So it's and then in 2021, we've finally released an Australian whisky, which was 147.1 Jacaranda Jam, which was hugely well received and sold out in a number of seconds online. And now this month we're going to be looking at the next iteration in that evolution, I guess.
And do you guys talk on the record about who the distilleries actually are?
I mean, we give hints big enough to drive a car through them. We can say that Distillery 148 is a Port Melbourne-based distillery that was founded by David Vitale many years ago. So we don't hide that, we don't try to, but we just tend not to talk about the distillery names for a couple of reasons. One is because we want members to experience the flavour of that whisky, take any sort of preconceived notions about what it should taste like, what that house style is that we're going to be far removed from in many ways, and keep the focus on flavour rather than brand. And the second reason we keep the coding system and at the society is because when they're not competing with those distilleries that we're sourcing this great spirit from with their own brand. These distilleries that sometimes spend millions of dollars a year on branding and on marketing their distillery, if we're able to then source great spirit and not compete against them, we're just sort of providing a small number of casks here and there direct to our membership, then that's all that matters.
The backlash that you mentioned before with the Irish whisky releases, I guess the world of whisky has just changed so much since then, hasn't it? And it would probably be remiss for the society to ignore what's happening on its own home turf in Australia.
Absolutely. And it seems like there's a lot going on in Australian whisky. I'd say it's had some growing pains, especially in the last sort of 5 or 6 years. It's absolutely exploded in the number of distilleries, but also in the quality has been changing, and I think it's been getting progressively better. We've looked at Australian whisky a number of times over the years. In fact, over the last two decades of the branch, there's been discussions about Australian whisky. This is not a new thing for us, but it always came down to the quality wasn't quite there, or the price didn't make sense, and the output wasn't really viable. If you're talking with a distillery where they might push out 12,000 litres a year, and we go in saying, can we buy 1,000 litres or something and put them in some casks, that's a huge chunk of their output. Why would they sell it to us when they can barely keep up with their own demand? The combination of factors came along that it made sense for us to properly re-explore it in the last couple of years, and now we've seen the results of that this year. We pay less attention to regionality and even country. I find regionality in Scotch whisky to be almost a null point these days. If you have peated Speyside as an unpeated Isla whiskies, I mean, what do the regions really mean in terms of flavour anymore? The regions mean even less sometimes when it comes to international whisky. I could probably pull most people, put a Japanese or a Scotch whisky side by side, and they wouldn't be able to spot the difference.
And so this is going to be an ongoing thing. We're going to see bottlings from some other distilleries come out over the next months and years.
Yes, we are. There might be a little bit of a gap between these next couple of releases and then ones after because we need some time. Of course, you can't cheat the maturation process, and we need some time in cask for a few that we're working on at the moment. And we're working with a number of distilleries around Australia, which is really exciting with these casks as well. We've picked them out with the team. We've basically had free reign of the warehouse to pick out what we wanted rather than sort of here's the cask that you can bottle from us. it's as big an honor for us to bottle that distillery as it is for them to have be bottled by us. Because by being bottled by the iconic Scotch Malt Whisky Society and being known by members internationally is a huge boon for them in their core range as well.
Sure.
So it works both ways, and it's a huge boon for us because we can say we've allocated a code, 148, to this distillery, and we can work with them in the future on sourcing some incredible spirits and bottling them, and it's all in the pursuit of flavour. That's all we care about.
Scotch Malt Whisky Society Australia members will be able to purchase Cask 148.1 on Friday, October 1, with 148.2 to follow in early 2022. And remember, you can catch the Society's cellar master, Andrew Durbidge, discussing Australian whisky in Season 2 of the Drinks Adventures podcast. Sober, the Indigenous-owned non-alcoholic beer brand, has launched an equity crowdfunding campaign. Founded in 2017 by Gamilaroi man and psychologist Dr. Clinton Schultz and his wife Lozen McDermid, Sober, that's spelled S-O-B-A-H, has to date contract produced its beers, all of which are brewed or infused with Australian native botanicals. In a recent webinar, Schultz and McDermid tabled the company's plans to build its own brewery and, if enough funds are raised, a cafe and gallery, along with event and wellness spaces.
I come from pretty damn humble beginnings. I've always wanted to look at avenues that help people who don't have a lot of spare money actually enter different sectors. And this is a perfect opportunity for us to be able to get people on our journey with us who have supported us for a long time, who may not have a lot of spare cash. That's the main reason for me is I want it to be open and accessible to anybody who wants to be a part of the continuing Sober journey.
Schultz says equity crowdfunding will also enable Sober to remain a First Nations-owned company.
The best way for Lozen and I to ensure that is for us to maintain at least 51% of the company. This is about it being First Nations-owned, First Nations-driven, and really being able to support and give back to First Nations causes.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, being a profitable company, we want to be able to show that you can be a profitable company and do it in a really ethical way that allows you to still give back and do some good.
Further details on the campaign are available on the Birchall website. That's it for Season 10 of the Drinks Adventures podcast. Thank you, as always, for listening and for all your support. I need to take a short breather and get organised for Season 11. I'll be back with you again very soon.